Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Murphy versus Campbell.
May it please the court, Mr. Winston Krause will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Winston Krause. I'm a lawyer here in Austin. I'm a tax lawyer, board certified specialist, and because of that, I'm going to be arguing for the petitioners in this case, since it primarily involves tax issues involved in accounting malpractice. The parties involved...
Do I have to give you a special expertise about statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a good answer.
thank you. The parties, petitioner parties, are taxpayers in this case. They were forced to pay additional taxes that they were represented that they weren't supposed to have to pay. They engaged in a transaction, a major business transaction, on the basis of this advice. The advice turned out to be wrong, and as a result, when all of the litigation involving the tax dispute was over with, within 2 years, the petitioners filed their lawsuit against the defendant accountants. The trial court dismissed all claims of the petitioners on a general dismissal based on a motion for summary judgment from the defendants. And then the third court of appeals affirmed the dismissal on the basis of statute of limitation of all claims except for the fraud claim, which the third court reversed and remanded to the trial court on the basis that the fraud claim had been brought within 4 years from a certain date that we'll discuss. What petitioners are requesting the court to do today is to reverse the third court of appeals as to its affirmance and to remand to the trial court all the claims, and then to, as to the fraud claim, to affirm the third court of appeals. To assist with the argument today, I provided an illustrative timeline to the justices, and it will be helpful to be able to refer that to that in the discussion, especially since the running of time is important from various events in determining whether or not the limitations had run when the petitioners filed their claim against the defendants. In 1983 is when the advice was actually rendered. The parties were in the middle of a major transaction. The petitioners had the option of not going forward with the transaction. And if the advice had been correct, then if they had received correct advice, they would not have gone through with the transaction. It was the sale of all of the assets of a company that owned 125 convenience store locations. So this is the major transaction, the transaction of a lifetime to these petitioners. A year later, the corporation dissolves.
Was he just selling the assets of the company?
The corporation was selling all of its assets to another corporation. And then the corporation received the proceeds and dissolved, giving the proceeds to the shareholders, which occurred on April 24 of 1984. And both of those transactions, both the authorizing of the transaction in principle, had to require the shareholders to give their approval. So the corporation could not engage in the transaction without shareholder approval. Plus, and one important point is, the corporation could not vote the shares of the shareholders, it's black letter law, which gives rise to the shareholders' independent cause of action in this case. Anyway, the proceeds are distributed, the corporation dissolves, the shareholders take their money, and they go about their life. On June 11 of 1987, the IRS has come along, has audited. Everybody expected IRS to look at a transaction of this size. It issues a stat notice. The formal name is Notice of Deficiency, and the IRS is supposed to give taxpayers this notice that they disagree with what the taxpayers reported in their tax return.
Why is that a legal injury?
The reason it's not a legal injury is at that point taxpayers still don't owe any money to the IRS.
Well, presumably they wouldn't owe any money until final judgment to the tax court or any appellate court. But they knew that things were getting a little hot on June 11th, 1987, didn't
they? Well, it's admitted that there is a contingent liability, but it's contingent because nobody knew if it was there was going to be actually any liability, and nobody knew if there would actually be or what the amount would be.
And you never would really actually know until you've...
until the very end.
Until filed lawsuit and all appeals were exhausted and you lost.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
And you're asking us to toll limitations until exhaustion of all appeals?
Well, it's more along the line of the limitations don't begin until there's actual liability of the taxpayers. And in Atkins v. Crossland, which is the seminal case that taxpayers relied upon and which is a matter of discussion in the briefs as to interpretation of that case, the Supreme Court at that time analogized to a Stowers Doctrine case. And this point is not briefed in any of the in very many of the briefs, and that is that in the Stowers case, there has to be a final judgment against the insured for an amount in excess of the policy limits before the insured will have a claim against the insurer for the excess amount, final judgment.
On your timeline, you have the IRS is barred from assessing and collecting more tax than reported on your return.
Yes, Your Honor. The Internal Revenue Code is the basis for that, and in Section 6213, restrictions applicable to deficiencies, it provides that no assessment of a deficiency, and a deficiency is just the commissioner's, you know, his position that he thinks that the tax return doesn't state the correct amount. No assessment of any tax or any levy or proceeding for collection shall begin or be prosecuted until such notice has been mailed to the taxpayer, nor until the expiration of the 90-day period thereafter, nor if a petition has been filed with the tax court until the decision of the tax court has become final. So in federal law, a taxpayer owes nothing to the IRS through this whole process. No liability is established.
Because they've gone to tax.
Because
as it goes along.
As the IRS looks at it and then gives their notice, which is stat notice, which is simply, you know, their demand, their position.
But the situation in this case is that you knew as of June 11th that you had been, let's say, treated poorly by the defendants.
And not necessarily, Your Honor.
So as of June 11th, you thought, despite what the IRS was telling you, everything was fine and you still felt confident and comfortable with what the defendants had told you?
If at that point in time there was no issue to disagree with the Internal Revenue Service on, then what the taxpayers could have done was to not file a tax court petition, and at the end of 90 days, at that point the IRS could assess. And then when the assessment occurs, the taxpayers could be liable or would be liable at that point. However, the taxpayers disagreed with the assessment. That's just the IRS's view of it. And they filed a tax court petition. The tax court made its decision, rendered its decision on November 16, 1989. At this point, the IRS is still barred from any collection activity. They may not assess any tax yet because there's a 90-day appeal period.
Did Deloitte Touche help the plaintiffs with regard to that tax court petition?
They assisted the taxpayers after the notice of deficiency was issued.
Still claiming that they had done nothing wrong.
Well, the taxpayers' position was that the position shown on the tax return was correct. And it was their desire to advance that position, you know, all the way to the end.
Mr. Krause, as a part of the service that Touche Ross performed, did they undertake the obligation to see it through any contest by the IRS?
No, they didn't. But what they did do is they made a representation at the time the transaction was ongoing and at the time that the shareholders were trying to make a decision whether to go forward, they made a representation that their advice would result in a tax position that would be sustained by the tax court. And then there is evidence that the shareholders were seeking a representation from Touche Ross at the time that this was a good position, it was defensible, and that it would be sustained, and that they wanted no risk as far as additional taxes. They all knew that there were some taxes would be paid.
Under your rule, an action for legal malpractice would not accrue until after the harm was manifest in a final judgment. But we didn't even go that far in Hughes.
Well, in Hughes, the holding was that a final judgment was necessary in order to establish that a wrong had occurred, and that was the final action that established the wrong.
But the reason for that was the conflicting position it put the client in. On one hand, the lawyer there would accuse of malpractice as pursuing an appeal, trying to eliminate the harm, and we said we're not going to put on them the additional responsibility of filing a separate lawsuit in order to prevent limitations from running simultaneously.
The same situation would occur here. The same situation would occur here, and that is because if the statute of limitations were to begin to run on the date of stat notice, you know, just the IRS's administrative notice that they disagree with what's in the tax return, then the taxpayer is put in the untenable position of within 2 years having to file a lawsuit against his principal advisor.
Could have accrued if the taxpayer paid based upon the notice of deficiency immediately whenever they paid, right?
If
they chose to pay rather than to contest the tax court?
When the assessment was made and they paid the assessment, yes, Your Honor.
And so your proposed rule would essentially give the taxpayer the sole right to determine when the cause of action for malpractice accrues, wouldn't it? Because as soon as they quit fighting, then the cause of action is going to accrue. But as long as they keep fighting, any limitations would not accrue or would be told.
Well, to some extent that might be true, Your Honor, but that doesn't take into account that most taxpayers don't want to pay tax. And if they believe that they have a defensible position, then they will bring it to the tax court and let the judiciary decide what the situation is with that. And in fact, the reason why the tax court is so important is because in Section 6215 of the code, no part of the deficiency is determined by the secretary, the IRS, but disallowed by decision of the tax court shall be assessed or collected. So the tax court, as the final arbiter of what a taxpayer is due, is important to know how much the damages are, if any.
Any other questions? Thank you, Colonel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Farley Katz will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. The plaintiff's assertion that there is no liability, tax liability, until the taxes are finally assessed after tax court resolution or appellate resolution or settlement of a tax court case is simply untrue under the federal tax law. Internal Revenue Code Section 6151A, which is set forth in page 22 of our supplemental brief, states that a taxpayer is required to pay the liability to pay your taxes accrues, quote, when a return of tax is required without assessment or notice and demand from the secretary. We quoted several cases, all of which are to the following point. This is from a Southern District of Florida case affirmed by the Fifth Circuit, quote, regardless of when federal taxes are actually assessed, taxes are considered as due and owing and constitute a liability as of the date the tax return for the particular period is required to be filed. It is simply untrue that the liability does not exist and is unknowable down until the end.
Would that be for purposes of assessing interest and penalties?
No, ma'am. Interest and penalties run from the date the tax return was due. I'm sorry, yes. Interest and penalties run from the date the tax return is due, but it is a liability from that date for all purposes of federal law. Several of these cases come up in bankruptcy, for example, and the issue is when did this liability accrue? The liability accrued when the return was due, even though the final amount wasn't determined at that point.
Mr. Castle, do you agree with Mr. Krause's statement that Lloyd Tush, their representation about the work they performed would be good in the tax court?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The summary judgment is absolutely clear that Deloitte and Touche made no representation that the tax advice that there was no tax risk, or that the tax advice would withstand IRS audit despite the plaintiff's assertion. The issue came up involving the sale of the corporation's equipment.
Would Deloitte Touche have argued, had the plaintiffs conceded the assessment in 90 days without going to tax court, would your clients have said that they should have gone to tax court because that's the final decision, not this mere staff letter? Would you not have been here arguing that?
Probably not. That's really a question. That goes to a question of limitations. If we took that position and were unsuccessful, the lawsuit would have proceeded. In other words, the liability had already accrued. If somehow we were successful in that position, and then later it turns out that a court, then we would be judicially stopped from arguing that later that it had accrued.
I'm talking about there'd be no statute of limitations problem. They would not have contested the tax court. It would have been assessed. They would have sued your client for bad tax advice. Would your client have not taken the position that they gave away the farm because our position would have been good in the tax court?
It would always be available to a defendant to argue that, even if they fought it out to the bitter end and the tax court and the Fifth Circuit said they owed the taxes, the accountants are not a party to that lawsuit, and it would still be up to them to state, notwithstanding the fact that the court found these taxes to be due, we are not bound by that. You did not really owe these taxes. That would be possible for the defendants to argue. But getting back to the representations that were made, there were no representations made that this tax advice had no tax risk or that it would withstand audit. The plaintiffs had initially negotiated the sale of their corporation's assets. And initially the plaintiffs decided they would allocate $8 million to a certain group of assets. They recognized that that would result in a tax recapture on those assets. This is used equipment in their store. The buyer said, well, listen, why don't we just allocate, instead of allocating $8 million, let's just allocate your cost basis in those assets to those assets. And they came to the lawyers and said, would that reallocation eliminate the taxes? And we said, yes. But they admitted in deposition that there was no representation regarding what the IRS would or wouldn't do. Moreover, they admitted that they knew that the correctness of the allocation turns on the fair market value of the assets sold. That's the amount that needs to be allocated to them.
But clearly the accountants weren't just saying if you add this up wrong, it'll be less.
The accountants just said...
It surely meant that there's some substance to this advice.
Your Honor, the assets sold were assets in the plaintiff's 125 stores, which they are fully able to value. The appraisal that was ultimately done cost $40,000 to appraise those assets. The plaintiffs knew at the time of the allocation that they would have to spend a huge amount of money to do an appraisal. No appraisal was done. The $40,000 dwarfs the amount that was paid to Deloitte & Touche in 1983 for all their tax advice that whole year. So the plaintiffs admitted in deposition that they knew the allocation depended on the fair market value of the assets. They knew that no appraisal had been done. They admitted the IRS could come in and reappraise and reallocate, and they would owe additional taxes. There is thus no misrepresentation made in this case, and the plaintiffs were fully aware.
Well, doesn't that argument go to the merits of the, and not to the issue of when the limitations
begin to run? Well, Your Honor, it goes to really two issues. It goes to the merits. One of the grounds that we moved for summary judgment was that there was no misrepresentation made, and that is one of the grounds this case can be sustained on. It also goes to notice, assuming that a misrepresentation...
Was that point you just argued? Protected and
yes, Your Honor. It was in our motion for summary judgment, it was in our Court of Appeals brief, and it's in our briefs before this court.
As a cross point.
That's correct.
Okay.
The statement regarding June 11th, whether the plaintiffs knew they had been injured, Justice Abbott, and the plaintiffs have stated this morning they did not know, is absolutely untrue. Rochester testified that he was shocked and testified that they discussed suing the plaintiffs as of that very date. Now, the test for accrual, oh, by the way, one more thing, Your Honor. They assert that they needed to take that the inconsistent position concern here justifies a tolling. Well, first of all, tolling is an exception. It's not the general rule. Second of all, there are no inconsistent positions here. In the tax court, they argue that the assets were worth the amount that had been allocated to them, and they obtained an appraisal for $40,000, which determined that were actually worth a little bit less than the amount that had been allocated to them. The tax court, they settled the tax court case for saying they were worth a little bit more than was allocated to them. Now, they are not changing their positions. They are not coming forward and saying, yes, the assets were worth more, and you didn't tell us that. They have admitted in deposition that appraisal, which determined the assets were worth the amount allocated to them, was perfectly fine and correct.
So the deal is that they knew what was going on all along. They knew about this potential liability. They took the risk, gambled, and lost.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We maintain it's really a case of abuse, of lawsuit abuse.
And do you have evidence in the record indicating that you told them that there was a gamble they likely would lose, and they acknowledged that?
We have direct testimony from Hawkins, who was the president of the corporation, who admits that he knew that there was a tax risk, that the IRS could come in and reject the allocation and assert more taxes. He also admits that there was no discussion at the director's meeting about whether or not the IRS would accept this and whether it would sustain an audit.
So really your position is this is just a matter of disclosure to the client. If the CPAs had said, well, this is our advice, and you can take the risk or take a conservative or aggressive position, and if the taxpayer decides to take an aggressive position, then there can't be any inconsistent positions that would justify the Hughes versus Mahaney tolling provision.
I believe that's correct. But really what the plaintiffs are complaining about here, as I read their complaint, is they are asserting that they were told, that there was falsely told there was no tax risk. In fact, there is no such evidence. But assuming that they had been falsely told that there was no tax risk, the question of accrual of their causes of action then depends on analysis of whether we're dealing with lawful conduct or unlawful conduct. Let's take the unlawful conduct first. Take the fraud. If it's unlawful conduct that they're bringing an action for fraud, that's unlawful conduct. It is black letter law that a cause of action for fraud accrues when the conduct accrues, when the fraudulent conduct accrues.
Part of the case is here.
It is, Judge. It is here because the Court of Appeals erroneously applied the negligence accrual analysis to fraud. It said that no, fraud didn't accrue in 1983 when these plaintiffs were allegedly falsely told there was no risk and they engaged in a transaction that really did have risk. It didn't accrue then. The Court of Appeals mistakenly applied the analysis that all the other courts have applied to lawful conduct tax negligence cases and said, no, that cause didn't accrue really until they got their notice of deficiency. So that it is before on our cross writ. Now, if there was fraud, we maintain there was no fraud. It occurred in 1983. The plaintiffs were allegedly told that there was no risk. They engaged in a transaction that, lo and behold, had serious tax risk. We maintain that they knew about it, but whether they knew about it or not, they were injured at that point. The only question then is discovery. They have not denied discovery. They have not pled that there is delayed discovery of their claims about fraudulent, about misrepresentation about the tax risk.
This does turn on inconsistency of positions that is taken today. The malpractice occurred as opposed to before the tax court and the IRS that there was nothing that was done wrong. Would you have us determine whether limitations should be told based upon the facts of an individual case as opposed to classes of cases?
Well,
I mean, there might be some cases like this where there would be an inconsistent position, even though you don't think it happened here.
It would really require a case-by-case analysis to see whether or not there is an inconsistent position, to see what the inconsistent position is, to see whether or not the defendants bear any responsibility for that inconsistent position, or whether it would be unfair to the plaintiff to say to the plaintiff, well, those are inconsistent positions, but every day in every court, people come in and have to take inconsistent positions. For example, in a lawsuit, a party may commonly plead three or four alternative pleadings inconsistently. That doesn't automatically give him the right to sever his case and have three or four trials to try each one separately. He's required to try them all at once. So you really need to balance all that stuff. To get back to this case, though, the plaintiffs in the tax court argued that the equipment was worth the amount that was allocated to it, and the patently settled thing was worth a little more. They're not coming, they haven't changed their position. They're not coming here and saying, hey, it really was worth more, and you misrepresented that to us. They have admitted that the $40,000 appraisal they bought was perfectly fine and correct. There's no reason to think there's anything wrong with that appraisal. So they're saying, yeah, that equipment can be worth the amount that we originally recorded at, but you didn't tell us there was risk. You didn't tell us there was risk, or you told us there was no risk when in fact there was risk. So they have not taken inconsistent positions here, and their concerns are purely theoretical, and I do not believe that there's any reason for a wholesale tolling rule throughout tax malpractice cases, because I don't see any reason to believe that normally they will have inconsistent positions or that the inconsistent positions will really be properly chargeable to the defendant.
What about when you include the aspect that you are, your clients are fiduciaries? There's a fiduciary relationship here, and that should provide some tolling.
Well, I don't believe that fiduciary relationship alone justifies tolling. I think you have to analyze, because tolling is the rare exception in these cases, you have to analyze what position were they put in, is it unfair to them to make them go ahead. In this case, there's no inconsistent positions, it's purely a theoretical concern of theirs.
What about their claim that you, or again your client, also did some work for, represented some people on the other side of the deal they were involved in? To answer that for one, and the second part of it, are there any real damages resulting from that?
Yes, Your Honor. The allegation is that there was a belated discovery. This is the only allegation of any belated discovery. Everything else, they have never disputed that they were on notice from day one. They've never pled tolling, they've never pled belated discovery, and they've never contended there's any belated discovery, with the sole exception of their argument that in 1994 they suddenly discovered that the defendant accountants had provided some advice to the purchasers of Colonial's assets. Well, first of all, as Your Honor points out, that in itself does not provide any independent ground for a fraud cause of action. It doesn't result in any injury unless there is otherwise injury. If the tax advice that was given was correct, the plaintiffs would have suffered no injury despite the fact that there could have been one or more conflicts of interest. They had no adverse effect or injury on the plaintiffs. But significantly, the plaintiffs, there is in fact no summary judgment evidence before the court that there even was such a conflict of interest. This came up in response to our motion for summary judgment in which we laid out all the evidence establishing that the plaintiffs had conceded there was no fraud. They conceded that from day one, they knew that the allocation turned into fair market value. They knew the IRS could reject it. The defendants had made no representation whatsoever that the IRS would accept that allocation. So we had made a prima facie showing that there was no fraud. They came back and said, wait a minute, we just discovered that there was this alleged conflict of interest, and all they did was put in some affidavits stating that we learned recently that Touche Ross had provided some services to the plaintiffs at the time the transaction was going on. There is no evidence before the court that Touche Ross was providing services to the purchaser of Colonial's assets with respect to that transaction. The purchaser of Colonial's assets was a huge national convenience stores. Touche Ross may have provided all sorts of unrelated tax and accounting advice to national convenience stores, and there would be no conflict of interest unless they were on the opposite side of this particular transaction, unless they were giving advice on this transaction. And there's no evidence whatsoever in this court that occurred. And because we had made the prima facie showing here, the burden shifted to the plaintiffs at that point to come forward with some evidence that there really was a fraud problem. Now, I'll point out that the Court of Appeals below mistakenly stated that fraud was only alleged in 1984 after this discovery. That's absolutely incorrect. The original complaints in this case filed in 1991 and 1992 alleged fraud, unquestionably. They alleged that the Colonial and the plaintiffs had been given false advice regarding the tax allocation on its sale. They alleged it was intentional, malicious, and knowing, and they asserted common law actions for fraud from the beginning. So finally, their allegation that this conflict of interest somehow prevented them from discovering fraud is absolutely untrue.
In some cases, whether few or many, the prospective malpractice plaintiffs would be taking inconsistent positions in that lawsuit and in the ongoing tax dispute. In those cases, is there any reason not to apply the same tolling rule that we did in Heath?
I believe there is not, and I would refer the court, for example, to the Supreme Court of California's 1995 decision in International Engine Parts that was cited by the Moody Foundation amicus brief filed in this court. There, the California Supreme Court concluded, among other things, that in Atkins, this court meant notice of deficiency, not technical assessment in a technical tax lawyer's sense, and analyzed the issue of tolling and said, we're not going to toll it. We're going to balance it. We're going to state that at the time the return is filed, maybe too early, at the time the case is over and you've gone through all your appeals, is too late. I mean, that could be 20 years, I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. We gave examples where it could take 10 years to even get into the tax court, and it could take years beyond that. And they said they apply no tolling. Hughes v. Mahaney turned to all sorts of other considerations that relate specifically to attorneys and don't apply here. And for one of those considerations, as an illustration, is that in Hughes, the attorney's malpractice became the very issue in the underlying suit. The other side seized on that malpractice and made that the very issue. Touche Ross's alleged malpractice is not an issue in the tax court. The tax court turned on one thing and one thing only: what was the fair market value of the equipment?
But if it were, if the circumstances were different, what sense does it make to require the taxpayer to file a malpractice suit in the middle of tax litigation when it cannot be determined either whether the defendant was negligent or what the damages were until that litigation is concluded?
Your Honor, there can be circumstances where that happens, but I don't believe that is going to be the standard situation. For example, if you look at the notice of deficiency date, the taxpayer, if that is the date that the California court held, that marked not only an outer boundary of accrual, but the California court applied a bright line test, if you analyze the notice of deficiency date, the taxpayer would have 2 years from that time. He's got to get an attorney, he's got to have his case analyzed, he's got to fight his case out in the tax court. By that time, he is going to have a pretty good idea as to whether or not he's got any claims of malpractice.
But you just said there could be cases that went on 10 or 20 years.
There could be some cases out there where you could be put in an inconsistent position, but I would not let that tail wag the entire dog of saying that we should have a wholesale limitations of tolling when tolling is ultimately an exception rather than the rule.
Aren't you also saying, though, that Hughes versus Mahaney is an incorrect rule to be applied in a case, for example, where a lawyer advises a client that, look, here's the situation, we can take course A or course B, and I'm your advocate, I'm your lawyer, I'm not going to do anything unethical, but I'm going to do what you choose for me to do in terms of the course of action in prosecuting the lawsuit. It's up to you, client. Are you saying that under those circumstances that there isn't necessarily the kind of inconsistent position taken that warrants the tolling rule we announced in Hughes, even in a legal malpractice case?
Well, Your Honor, again, Hughes was by its terms restricted to attorneys. all the lower appellate courts that have considered Hughes have held we really want to limit that only to attorneys. If you open it up and say that any time a party gives anyone else advice and that they could possibly take inconsistent positions, you'd be opening up far too much. There are special considerations that attorneys have. There are special considerations there where the attorney's negligence itself became the very issue in the underlying litigation. That's not true in this sort of case. Whether or not Touche Ross was negligent or fraudulent or not negligent or fraudulent would never be mentioned in the tax court. That is not an issue. The tax court case would not resolve Touche Ross's liability. In Hughes v. Mahaney, this court concluded that the underlying case would, as a practical matter, resolve the negligence claim against the attorney because the attorney's negligence became the very issue. That's not true in this case, and I see no reason why, when the court's not faced with particular facts, the court should adopt this wholesale tolling rule, should extend a wholesale tolling rule to an entire another area of the law.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
May it please the court. It is true that Mr. Katz says that every taxpayer is required to self-assess and make a return. However, the types of taxes that we're talking about are where the IRS looks at the return and decides that the correct amount is something different than that. That causes a whole deficiency procedure where the IRS, you know, as the other party to the dispute, you know, starts an investigation and, you know, notifies the other party, and then the other party, the taxpayer, has the right to go to court, get an impartial third-party tribunal to decide the matter.
Mr. Krause, with regard to that amount, that valuation, the services rendered by Touche Ross, they did not guarantee to your clients that their services would withstand an IRS audit.
Well, there was summary judgment evidence to the contrary, their affidavits from the principals at the meeting as to what was represented to them. And so I can't think of things that are better for to be, you know, set out in the trial court than many of the issues that was discussed just a minute ago about, well, what happened in the meeting? What were the representations that were made to the taxpayers?
What were those representations?
Well, the petitioners say that the representations were that that you, Touche Ross, know our requirement for approving this transaction is that we want X amount after tax. And so this new idea of reallocating the purchase price, if you believe that that is good law and will be sustained, then gets us the X amount after tax, then we will approve it. But we do not want to have a situation where that's not going to be the case. How good is your advice? And the representation was that it will withstand scrutiny in the tax court. It was disclosed that, yes, IRS may not like it, and these people were sophisticated businessmen. They were willing to take the risk that the IRS would dispute it, but they would prevail in tax court.
If those disclaimers were made, where's the fraud?
The fraud was that it represented that they had that the tax advice was good and that they had competently rendered the advice and that their advice was conflict free.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go ahead.
So those would be some of the implied warranties that might go along with that. They relied on the advice in order to decide whether or not to engage in the transaction.
But your clients knew when they made the decision that there was some risk, some possibility of an IRS audit and that you could come out on the losing end of that audit.
No, Your Honor. They knew that the IRS would probably look at it, there would be an audit, and that the IRS may contest it. But they believed that it was represented to them that in the end, the allocation would prevail. And whether or not, you know, the allocation was good or whether or not it was bad, you know, as to what these disclosures are, those are things that the trial court ought to consider and that the jury ought to have a chance to look at.
But isn't the summary judgment evidence unfair because, if I recall, it seems as though they say that they believe that, but they do not say that the basis of their belief is anything that Touche Ross did.
The basis for the belief was that specific questions were asked of the representative of Touche Ross on the spot, and specific responses were given to those questions. And so it was the belief of the petitioners that they were given the go-ahead, that they had undertaken a low-risk transaction. They knew it was going to be scrutinized, but in the end, they were under the belief that they received advice that they would prevail. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone through the transaction. They could have easily voted to not go forward.
On what date did the services provided by Deloitte and Touche terminate?
They provided active services through the audit phase, and then after the notice of deficiency came out, then they provided only assistance.
And so what date did they terminate? Do you know?
I don't know.
Is it in the record the last services that were billed by?
It may not be, because a lot of the deposition testimony was not incorporated as part of the summary judgment record, which is really all that's before the court.
Is that significant? When their service
is
terminated?
No, Your Honor, because there's no legal injury. What the defendants would like is for multiple lawsuits to be initiated, you know, by a taxpayer to have, you know, more than one lawyer. A tax lawyer will typically only litigate tax disputes. Then the taxpayer would be required to hire general commercial lawyers to sue their accountants. The accountants have to hire lawyers, and so now we've got all that going. And then there's an amicus brief that says, oh, well, we have to abate. Well, that's ridiculous, because let's wait and see what happens in the end. Let's see if, in fact, a legal injury is sustained and how much it's going to be.
Would you have a claim for attorney's fees, even if you won the case in tax court, would you have a claim for attorney's fees incurred as a result of getting involved in litigation to defend the decision made by Deloitte and Touche?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and I don't know. However,
would you think about it?
I'd be happy to, and I'd be happy to submit a supplemental brief on it.
I know the court would appreciate any input either side has.
As far as when petitioners went to tax court, at that point they hired lawyers and were still being assisted by the accountants who had prepared the tax advice.
Yes, Your Honor, there was some assistance. However, some other accountants were engaged for the, I guess, the theory
assist
that, yes. So both Touche Ross and these other accountants assisted the lawyers at Locke, Brunell, and Dallas to prosecute the tax court case.
If the plaintiff, from the prospective malpractice case, in this case the taxpayer, is not put in the position of taking inconsistent positions, then is there any reason to apply a tolling rule as did it here?
Probably the best reason would be that without a tolling rule, then this taxpayer is now required to finance multiple lawsuits, have probably more than one lawyer, to poison the relationship that he has with the CPA, to jeopardize the confidential relationship that he has with his accountant that, you know, is part of the Public Accountancy Act, and that here he is now attacking the person who actually gave him the advice that he wants to rely upon. And so,
any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's oral arguments, and all the foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay.